For the rest of the show, I'll be talking with my friend Sarah Smarsh. She's a writer born and raised in Kansas with a personal story that makes her highly attuned to class issues. We'll be getting her read on some recent headlines. Sarah Smarsh, Class Act, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Gina. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the story that will help our listeners get to know you and how you hear the news. You wrote an essay for The New Yorker online about the pending Kansas law capping ATM withdrawals at $25 for welfare recipients when they use their state-issued debit cards. When you heard about this Kansas law for the first time, what sprang to mind?
Well, as you mentioned, I have some personal experience with just having grown up in a low-income environment that caused me to immediately relate to the story on a personal level. In terms of my role as a member of the media, I certainly learned about the law through the press, and it actually did get some, I would say, ample coverage at the local level and even to some extent the national level. But I could talk some about.
Well, start with the personal stories that came flooding to your mind that you touched on in the New Yorker story, but that some of our listeners may not have read.
Yeah. So basically, this law it had kind of two components. Initially, it was kind of intended to micromanage what public assistance recipients could and couldn't purchase with their welfare, so to speak, funds. And those sorts of laws are on the books in a lot of states. This law then, the Kansas legislature added an amendment during the spring that kind of took it to a whole new level in terms of acting as a sort of middleman between federal assistance funds and Kansas citizens by, as you said, limiting the amount of cash that they could take out of ATMs with these debit cards that now regulate the funding. So for me, I immediately, connecting with it on a personal level, understood deeply why, what is the difference between accessing something in the form of cash and accessing something as an electronic transaction. One allows a state government to enforce some control and, as I said, micromanagement. And this is a point that I think it might be lost on some people. When you have a limited amount of actual cash that you can access, maybe there are a lot of Americans right now living on credit cards, for example, that actually preclude you from a lot of really basic day-to-day needs.
In the New Yorker article, you write about memories of being in lines to use an ATM card or in lines for cash registers.
Yeah, so my I reference at the opening of the essay, just growing up, my just emotional response to being anywhere where a financial transaction was going to take place. I am just old enough that ATMs weren't necessarily as numerous as they are now, but certainly being in like bank teller lines and making some kind of withdrawal, a question that was just like deep in my bones was, is there enough money? And sometimes there wasn't, and cards were rejected and transactions were declined and cash was not had that was needed. And so to imagine this law that then, already you have a person in poverty who is turning to a machine to distribute something that is necessary for survival and feeding children, and now there is this additional hurdle to jump.
You also write about the distinction between a free lunch card you used at school versus when you got older and deposited need-based scholarship checks into a bank account.
Yeah, so that would again be the distinction between, a piece of kind of electronically regulated plastic, which would be the lunch card, or that's, I think, how they present now. At the very least, it's sort of a non-cash symbol for something that sets you apart from other people in the line and immediately identifies someone along class lines. And so for me as a child, that was often embarrassing and a source of ridicule. And I mentioned in the essay, sometimes I skipped lunch rather than experience that moment. Now, when I got merit-based and more to the point, financial need-based aid as a college student, that came in the form of checks that I then deposited in my account and had the freedom to use as cash. And that's where we get into this kind of classist idea that people in poverty aren't equipped with the proper decision-making skills to handle that, the basically the freedom that cash provides. And certainly fraud exists in all of these sorts of systems, but I mentioned in the piece that it's really kind of a hypocritical onus that we place on the poor to demonstrate that they can handle this sort of assistance that people really at all classes receive, variations on government welfare, so to speak.
Something we've talked about as friends is related to a book that you've really been working on since you were a child, essentially, a memoir of your family. And a long time ago, you told me that you wanted to write this because the rural white poor are often spoken and written about, but almost never on their own behalf. So what do you think that this vantage point brings to this particular discussion around this Kansas ATM law?
Yeah, well, I think that that impulse of mine for the book and for the ATM story is to, like you said, give a voice to a population that by way of basically being marginalized from higher education and other opportunities that might lead one into a role as a professional media of the member. I happen to now kind of straddle those cultures. And so while I would never want to speak for a group of people, I can only speak for myself. At least that this one perspective is one that is rare in public discourse. So, you know, one example with So when an editor asked me to write about the ATM story, as I said, it had already been reported on. What I had an opportunity to bring to the table was a personal perspective that we've been describing. And I think that's really the argument for diversifying media along a lot of lines, including class.
Let's break down a couple more headlines really quickly before we go. When the Charleston, South Carolina shooting led to a national discussion about the Confederate flag, what was your read on the tenor of that national discussion?
Yeah, the media historically is obsessed with images of poor white rural Americans with the Confederate flag, and that is a real phenomenon, and racism certainly exists among that class. What is overlooked and never discussed in media discourse that I'm sensitive to along these lines is the fact that the Confederate flag represents historically a slave trade economy in which wealthy landowners essentially were protecting their own interests. So when a state government like South Carolina flies the Confederate flag, that government is not populated by poor whites, and it's not poor whites who pass Jim Crow laws. I would wager that for every Confederate flag bumper sticker on a beat-up pickup truck, there is some sort of valuable Confederacy relic in a wealthier person's home tucked away in a chest. So I think that, you know, racism exists at all class levels. It just manifests differently depending on which one you're honing in on.
And for something a few people out there might not have interpreted as a class story in the same way that probably the Confederate flag, like there is some evident, I don't know, like lumping together of people under a lot of labels in terms of where they stand on that issue. But Caitlyn Jenner was awarded this year's Arthur Ashe Courage Award, given out every year by ESPN. The move was controversial, and you see a class element in the headlines here too.
I do. Not specifically to an LGBTQ story unto itself that certainly transcends class, but in the social media discourse that I saw rear up around that headline, there was a lot of hate speech and just kind of hateful vitriol by people all across all gender lines toward the transgender community. And then what an awkward position for me as someone who identifies as a progressive liberal along a lot of lines was to see a backlash against that hate speech with more hate speech, which essentially amounted to assuming that anyone with those more close-minded opinions is of a certain class, and terms like backwards, rednecks, white trash, which I personally think is hate speech itself, get used to kind of ironically defer an unfair generalization and stereotype of one group onto another.
As painful as it may be, could you talk a little bit about those terms and what they bring up for you? I mean, particularly redneck and white trash, which of course, yeah, we're acknowledging that those are not sensitive terms.
Yeah, yeah. They're not, and yet I see headlines from, you know, reputable news outlets using those terms, maybe in quotation marks, but in a way that's so casual and insensitive that I don't think that epithets about other groups of people would pass muster in the same way. Which I think is indicative of how little we've examined this. Let's say with, to go along just kind of public media discourse, there's just Saturday I met a woman who was telling me she works in the Ozarks in Missouri, and the people in Hill Country, as she said, are inbred. And this is something that comes, you know, I'll see in social media threads. Someone is saying, oh, those backwoods inbreds are rejecting the transgender movement or whatever. And I feel quite confident that those sorts of that sort of closed-mindedness exists at all levels of class society. But along the inbreeding term, there's just a few years ago, I remember Dick Cheney joked that there were people on both sides of his family with the last name of Cheney. And he said, and I'm not even from West Virginia, haha. And the reference, you know, of course, we have Deliverance and all these pieces of pop culture that associate that idea with a group of people. There's a great book
in terms of geography, mm-hmm. in addition to class. I mean, there is, yeah. I don't know if there is a word for geography-ism.
Well, I think that it's hard to separate those two because the isolation of those groups is geographically is what precludes them often from having a voice and being an easy scapegoat. So, and socioeconomic.
So you're saying like being in a rural area separates you from maybe mainstream discourse in some way?
It does, and there's not like a perfect class correlation there, but certainly, you know, Appalachia as a subsect of America is disproportionately more poor than, let's say, you know, the Los Angeles area. So there's a sociologist at Temple named Matt Ray. He wrote a book called Not Quite White that has a great history of about this particular kind of correlation that we're discussing. To go back to that the term about insinuating that a group of people is inbred and therefore inferior and stupid. In the 1830s and 40s, abolitionists were using economic lines to fight against the slave trade. And one of the points that they made to try to find some empathy within the white community was there are poor whites are marginalized as not being landowners. Poverty is occurring within the white community in relationship to this issue. And pro-slavery factions basically put forth this rebuttal that they weren't, poor whites weren't in poverty because of their rural isolation or their or the slave trade, but because they had hereditary defects and bad blood. So that led to actually a eugenics in the 1920s that was targeted at poor whites.
Wow. Well, on the note of eugenics in the United States of America, Kansas writer Sarah Smarsh, our time is up. Where can people go to find out when you've got a new essay out?
SarahSmarsh.com is my website, and I keep it pretty up to date.